The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, the difference between now and 2008. I mean, let's face it. 2008 was a tumultuous year. There was a currency crisis, but a lot of people right now are starting to wonder, has this thing been solved or has it at least been delayed?
Well, and I think that's where the marketing and PR campaigns that JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and other institutions have put out there, that we don't have to be concerned about what PIMCO has called the new normal. We're back to the old normal. And if you look at the new jobs numbers, 9.8 to 9.4.
Okay, now hold on, David, just a second. Explain what you're talking about on that 9.8 to 9.4 number.
Well, and we can look at this in greater depth later in the conversation today, Kevin, but it's just that there are these data points that Wall Street firms are looking to and heralding as the turn in the market.
Right.
In fact, things are getting better. What's interesting is if you look beneath the surface, you can see that the money is flowing, and there is a benefit to quantitative easing, one, and likely to be with quantitative easing,
two. It's amazing what 2 or 3 or 4 trillion will buy.
But it stays sort of locked in a certain tier. And this is not meant to be a classist comment, Kevin, but there's a reason why Tiffany's and Saks Fifth Avenue are doing quite well.
And Louis Vuitton.
Vuitton as well. But at the same time, Walmart and Best Buy and Target are struggling.
So the store for the common man right now is still feeling recession.
Right.
But not the upper crust.
Exactly. And as a traveler around the country, Kevin, you get this sense going to money centers versus any other sort of center. Kevin, I mean, for instance, if you go to Seattle, if you go to Portland, I mean, these are obviously cities of significant size and importance in the country, but they're not money centers.
Right.
It's not San Francisco. It's not New York. And maybe to a lesser degree, Chicago, but these are cities where you can still feel and smell recession or depression. Hmm. And it's interesting because it really is the same difference as sort of the Tiffany's, Saks Fifth Avenue, Louis Vuitton. That set buys and buys heavily in Manhattan. But you don't see as much traffic through those kinds of stores in a place like Portland, Oregon.
So if we think of the haves and the have-nots, the haves right now are the people who are near the money centers. And the have-nots are the ones who are maybe near manufacturing or shipping.
Exactly. So there's a growing sense, Kevin, of tension, of discontent, of anger even, across these social strata. And we'll talk a little bit about Europe in a minute, but that's probably one of the most important things to be aware of as an investor coming into 2011, is the changes in social sentiment and the changes in the way people are calculating things, not intellectually, but in their emotions and the way they express those emotions, whether it's the polls or the voting booth or what have you.
You and I have talked before about the danger of unmet expectation. When they'd like to buy something, David, but they see that they can't. They don't have their money in the wallet. Maybe they can't get any more debt. And they're seeing somebody right next to them continuing to live the life that they did yesterday. There's an expectation change, and doesn't that bring resentment and a lot of frustration?
I think so, Kevin. I mean, I think a part of the frustration is in not being able to maintain the same lifestyle that you've known in the past, continue that on into the present or future, because there's variables that have changed, whether that is access to credit, whether that is pulling money out of your home as a makeshift ATM. I mean, there's a variety of ways in which we have funded our private largesse, and not to speak of our public largesse and the borrowing that occurs from the Treasury, but this private largesse has been funded by a credit boom. That credit boom is in large part behind us. Mm. Now, what are the social ramifications as people have gotten through a large part of their savings and have no access anymore to the equity, what little there may be in their homes? It requires a recalibration, Kevin. And with that comes an upset in expectations, as you're mentioning.
Well, you know, you think about it. Those expectations came with tomorrow's money yesterday. If you think about it, the way we've lived as a nation for decades now has really been taking tomorrow's money, putting it into today, and actually calling it normal.
Yeah,
now, there is a point when it has to be paid for.
Well, I mean, the perfect case in point is what you do every day with a credit card, or what I may do with a credit card every day. We spend money that is not ours with the intention of paying it back at the end of the month, or
right,
in some reasonable time period if you don't pay that off as a regular bill. But what happens? You're spending someone else's money, enjoying the fruits thereof, in sorting out how it gets paid off at some future date.
You know, that's something that we're seeing right now come to real fruition in Europe.
Kevin, it's interesting. We're going to spend some time today talking about currencies, particularly talking about gold and also talking about silver. Before we do, I think it's important to look at some of the shifts that have taken place even in the last few weeks in Europe, which are very, very significant.
So, David, is it political? Is it coming down as changed rules in the system, or is it economic? Is it just a basic vote against the euro at this point?
Hey, Kevin, it's you know, we like to think in terms of clear categories, and this is a good example of how things overlap when we're talking about economic or financial, political, geopolitical, how they actually do weave in and are interconnected. They're not sort of standalone categories. Kevin, you look at the elections which happened in Germany this last year.
Right.
And in Westphalia, a group that had been in power there for 20 or 30 years.
That was a shock to Merkel, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah.
But it happened in conjunction, Kevin, with a support by the European Central Bank of further bailout measures. And the folks in Westphalia basically said, by the way, we're the ones who are going to end up paying for this. We don't like it. Your participation in this sort of ECB project, we're not happy with, and it's not going to work for us. So you begin to see this sort of repartee between political constituency groups and decisions that are being made by central planners, whether it's central bankers or politicians, and their participation in a larger social or political structure. This is what we see happening in Europe today, and it's in tatters, Kevin. What happened this last week is fascinating because you've got the European Central Bank intervening and propping up the debt markets. They're buying Irish debt, they're buying Greek debt, they're buying Portuguese debt, and they're actually being complemented by purchases from China and Japan. I don't know what the calculus is behind the Chinese and Japanese purchases, except perhaps goodwill for the benefit of future trade. That could be. We'll have to see what their reasoning is as it unfolds.
Well, David, answer this for me if you would. It seems that so far, with all the European problems, and actually even here in America, the American problems, the people who actually have given the loans, the people who are the bond holders, they are still intact. They're still fully paid, even though you've got default across the board in a lot of these places.
That's exactly why there's pressure in the bond market here in recent weeks in Europe, because there's a proposal, and this may be like the FASB rules, which were proposed in 2008 and never came to fruition, but certainly sent jitters through the banking community and may have even precipitated a part of the collapse. These proposals are simply this: that bondholders participate in losses. Up to this point, bondholders have walked away virtually unscathed. Bondholders have been able to pass the buck, and the taxpayer has picked up the bill.
So it's coming from the masses, and they're paying basically for the people who are supposedly taking the risk to loan the money.
Exactly. I mean, and you know, and I know this too, stockholders have the most to lose and the most to gain in most investment scenarios. Preferred stockholders have a little bit less risk, and they're compensated a bit more in terms of the income component of that investment. So it's somewhere between, in terms of a balance sheet item, being a fixed income investment and being an equity investment.
But the bondholder is the last guy to lose.
He's the last guy to lose, and in this case, has lost little to nothing while the gap has been filled by the taxpayer. This is what is considered intolerable by who other than the taxpayer. And the taxpayer says, you know, this is all well and good that we want financial stability, and this is all well and good that we want a banking system that can accommodate our needs in terms of checking and savings and things of this nature, but you're changing my life. You're expecting me to work longer for less, and I don't even get my 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 weeks vacation, whatever it is in Europe.
Sure.
Guess what? They're going to the polls, and they're voting differently than they have in the past.
Do you think it's because they're starting to feel pain? And here's where I'm going with this. Back in the mid-90s, Americans bailed out Mexico. 79% of the public was against it at the time, yet you still had the usual list of suspects. You know, Geithner was involved with that, Summers was involved with that, Greenspan was involved with that. They did it anyway. But face it, in the mid-90s, were we really feeling pain? I mean, we may have disagreed, but we weren't feeling pain.
No, we weren't feeling pain, and so there was protest, but it didn't really matter. The question is, who's in control anymore? The world is largely run by financial institutions in terms of the influence and the capital flows, whether flows increase or decrease. You know, we're talking about making and breaking situations. If you looked at the most important people today on the planet, I would say that they're bankers.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying this from sort of a conspiratorial standpoint. You just even look at the components within the S&P or the Dow, and at a recent peak, the financials were the largest component part of the total mix. So whether it's the capital markets or actual influence in the economy, finance is huge in the developed world. I think, Kevin, this is where you're beginning to run into conflict. And we've been working through a book by Ian Bremmer, which sort of challenges the notion that capitalism has been and will always be in control. And actually, the rise of the state is more of the issue, present and future tense.
So command economy is coming back in, just like what Napier talked about last year. I mean, we're starting to see command economy, which is a form of socialist economy.
Well, and if not the extreme of a command economy, you certainly have the state saying, hey, wait a minute, we need a little bit more control here, and we're going to be taking the reins from you. That's what we have exactly here with this European proposal. It's the politicians looking out at the crowd and saying, do you hear that sound of discontent? We were hoping for applause, and instead we're getting booed. I think we need to change our cue cards and perhaps address the crowd slightly differently. What do they need to hear? What do they want to hear? What do they need to see in terms of actions which prove that we are for the people and not for the bankers? This is the point, is there's a change amongst the state apparatus that says we've got to at least posture as if we care about the people and the populace. So what does that look like? Okay, here's our proposal. And all of a sudden, what are they forcing the ECB to do?
Right.
They're forcing the ECB to intervene in the debt markets, because even the suggestion that bondholders should pay a part of the losses doesn't go over well in the marketplace, and it forces the ECB's hand.
Well, and what's the cost of that? The cost of that is inflation, ultimately, or devaluation of the currency. If you look at gold in euros right now, David, I mean, right now we've seen a little bit of a discount in dollars with gold, but actually in euros, aren't we close to an all-time high?
That's right. And just to put in perspective, you know, where gold is and where it's going, whether it's on the upside or downside, it's been virtually unscathed, untouched, uncorrected at all in euros. It's been a much stronger market than the dollar market, which is very significant. But, you know, to put this in context, Kevin, one of our guests this last year was Otmar Issing,
right,
the chief economist at the European Central Bank. He was one of the architects and spent more years working on the project and largely in control of the project, an eight-year stretch, which was the longest stretch allowed for any of the ECB participants or bankers. And yeah, I just want to quote something from this morning's New York Times. It says, with the failure, this is Otmar Issing, with the failure to make sovereign states' fiscal policies consistent with the conditions for the single currency area, Mr. Otmar Issing wrote in an article to be published this week, policymakers not only have weakened the functioning of monetary union, but have also called into question its very survival.
And this is a man who had more emotional skin in the game as far as this European Union than anyone.
And our conversation with him this last year, Kevin, was essentially, we have faith that this will work out. It has to work out.
Right.
And what you're beginning to see is questions or doubts amongst the faithful, the central bankers even, looking at the ECB, looking at the EMU, and saying there really are significant issues here, and I don't know that they're going to be solved. Kevin, elsewhere in the report, he said that the present seemingly unstoppable process towards further financial transfers will generate tensions of an economic and especially political kind. The longer this process is characterized by unsound conduct of individual member countries, the more these tensions will endanger the existence of the EMU.
Which he always knew was the major weakness, was the political disagreements. Not the financial disagreements, but the political disagreements.
And that's specifically what he's getting at, is a basic design flaw of the monetary union.
So is this currency story more of a currency tragedy?
Well, and that's the point, is that it's not just a tragedy in English. It's a tragedy in German. Mm. It's a tragedy in French. It's a tragedy in almost every language around the world, because it's a story that's being told not only in English, but in every country around the globe. Because, Kevin, it's not just the Fed. It's not just the ECB. It's the educational patterns which are consistent globally, which have our central bankers globally thinking and acting in lockstep.
David, is this realization of what's going on, especially possibly the breakup of the euro, what would turn gold exponential versus the linear move that we've experienced up to this point?
Well, Kevin, I think the great concern by central bankers and financial gurus around the world is simply this. We don't know what the consequences would be of the dominoes falling in the banking community. We tasted just a bit of that in 2008. Kevin, what was essentially a market for insurance, where you could say, I don't want to lose in this particular investment, so I'm going to buy a credit default swap on that particular asset and cover my downside. essentially going neutral in the market, has become a gambit for speculation and has become a casino without rules.
Right.
And it's all based on single written document. These are contracts that are written, and to see who pays and to see who the counterparties are and to enforce them is done not by the marketplace in nanoseconds, the way that most assets are handled, but in courtrooms over months or years. So the idea that we could have the financial markets embroiled and entangled in uncertainty with no end in sight leaves a very bitter taste in most bankers' mouths. And what do they do instead? They would say, we defend the market.
We've talked about no transparency in the past, but part of that transparency would come from standardization. We've had guests on that talk about that. There's no real standardization to those insurance contracts, is there?
No, there's not. And it's been proposed, Senate hearings, another guest on the program in recent years, Richard Buchstaber, has sat in front of our quote-unquote best and brightest in Washington, and they have listened to him. And he said, I was there. I've seen it. I've done it. Here's what you need. You need standardization. You need exchange-traded credit default swaps and CDOs and CLOs. If it's going to be a derivative, you have to bring it out of opacity and into the light. People have to see what it is, know what it is, and know how to value it on a minute-by-minute basis. This is the biggest issue, is we don't know what we've got. And that's really what people don't want to know. They can't know because of the potential unintended consequences into the financial and banking community.
It could literally crash the market just as soon as the realization came about. So it's a double-edged sword. If we really knew what these things were insuring and how they would pay, it may very well just put the light on the fact that this whole thing is bankrupt.
Which was the point of the FASB rules a few years ago when you looked at 161, and I think it was 158 or 168, I don't remember now. Those rules were intended to bring transparency to bank balance sheets, which in theory is a great idea. At least we know what's sitting there. And banks can't play the same kinds of games that Enron did, for instance, with their off-balance sheet entities sitting down in the Caymans. But listen, that would be tragic.
It'd be like asking Medusa to take her makeup off. It'd be like, oh my gosh, this is worse than I thought.
Yeah, I think, Kevin, that's the issue in Europe, is the reason why there is a penchant to bail out. Let me go back to one thing, Kevin, because it's not like this proposal for bondholders sharing and participating in losses will actually happen. It's a proposal. If it's implemented, it's not until 2012 before it comes live. I mean, these are things that are talked about and send jitters through the marketplace. But the reality is they will defend the markets at any cost.
Right.
And because of the European, the U.S., the global bias towards opacity and not transparency, guess what we have over the next 2, 3, 4 years? Inflation.
Right.
Inflation, because they will print money to make the problem go away, to cover over the fact that there are real structural and economic issues. This is what brings us to the point in conversation, Kevin, where we say, is it different than 2008 and 2009? Have we entered into recovery? When we look at statistics that are now flowing to us that imply that things are getting better, are they in fact getting better? Or do we need to dig a little deeper?
Well, let's look at retail sales then. If you're going to talk about that, are things getting better? We saw that retail sales improved this last quarter.
Well, the biggest component of growth in the retail sales figure was gas stations. And as we pointed out a few weeks ago, that's not the purchase of Snickers on the increase. That's not the purchase of Kit Kat bars and Pepsi.
That's the cost of a necessity. That's not the cost of, some sort of luxury.
People are spending more on gasoline because the price is going up, and they're forced to spend more out of their budget. So are sales returning to their normal levels, retail sales returning to their normal levels because the consumer is coming back in force, because he has newfound confidence in the economy?
Or are they just paying more for gas?
Are they just paying more for gas?
Well, then how does that affect corporate profits? It's not just the individual that has to buy gas. Corporations do, too, to make their widgets.
Kevin, Alcoa is a great case in point. They're one of the first to issue quarterly earnings, and this year they came out with a better-than-expected number.
Right.
That's great. So 21 cents per share is roughly where they came in on $5 to $6 billion in revenues. The interesting thing is that their revenues were virtually the same a few years ago, $5 to $6 billion per quarter. But guess what was better? Their earnings per share were 35 to 36 cents instead of 21 cents.
So what brought about the difference?
What's bringing about the difference is the rise in commodity costs. Their input costs are on the rise, and their margins are getting squeezed. Their profitability is getting squeezed. Their earnings per share is getting squeezed. And yet they can still run numbers that Wall Street shills say, this is impressive. You know, we're glad that Alcoa is back to normal. 21 cents will never be 36 cents, no matter how you slice and dice it. That's obtuse math. You can't think that things are getting better at Alcoa. Things were much better a few years ago, and they have not returned. They have not returned to what people consider to be a stable footing.
Well, and Alcoa is at least still making a profit. There are businesses. We just heard a story this morning about a poultry business that had not factored in the cost of corn. And actually, even though they would have been a profitable business, the inflation on the corn prices actually put them out of business.
And they sold for pennies in the dollar. This is a huge poultry company, Kevin. And this is what happens in the context of inflation being created, monetization occurring, there being a flow of capital from the central bank into the financial system, and it's going to go where it wants. Liquidity can be created, but it cannot be directed. Mm. And so where do we see it? We do see it show up in stocks. Where do we see it? We do see it show up in commodity prices. Where do we see it? Well, we do see it in bankers' bonuses. Certainly, yeah. December was a good period of time if you're a Goldman Sachs employee.
It's like you said before, there's no recession for the banker.
The new normal is the old normal at Goldman. Thank you very much. Another great year.
And just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Well, David, I'm going to narrow our focus since we're talking about commodities. Let's focus on silver for just a little bit, because silver is a metal that has just all of a sudden come alive. And what are your thoughts right now about silver?
Yeah, well, you know, it gets a little bit of both plays in terms of a gold alternative as a crisis metal or an insurance item to own. But it also, you know, in this environment where the general public is assuming a return to vibrancy in the economy, they also say, hey, but it's got the industrial component. Mm-hmm. If we're not in a deflationary recession, then maybe silver has some upside that gold doesn't. And in fact, we've seen a contraction over the last 3 to 4 months in the gold-silver ratio, very short period of time, from 65 to 47.
In other words, 65 ounces of silver for 1 ounce of gold, down to 47
right.
ounces of silver.
Yeah, on a relative basis, silver has far outperformed gold. And I think a part of that is on a performance hype that, yes, it will come alongside a recovering economy as an industrial metal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, that's just one opinion in one snapshot. I think there's better reasons to own it, and long-term, much more fundamental character to it. I wouldn't own it on the basis of an economic recovery, but it certainly is getting a tremendous amount of play here in the last 90 days. You see UBS, who even in September said this, price strength is not on firm ground. They said this further, we expect industrial demand to show some weakness and advise investors to avoid the metal. That's in September, Kevin.
Right.
So after a major move, I mean, again, we're talking 90 days and a major correction to the upside, UBS has this to say, silver prices remain well supported and have been able to trade repeatedly above $30 an ounce. And then they said further in one of the recent reports, temporarily prices could even hit $35 an ounce on physical interest in the metal due to firm economic activity. The bottom line, investors should make use of silver volatility for yield enhancement strategies at levels close to $25 an ounce. We will be willing to pick up the metal. How do you go from, Kevin, trading at $17.50 saying I'm negative to above 30 saying I'm positive? This is classic Wall Street maneuvering.
It reminds me of financial news on TV. I mean, these guys don't have a memory for an hour of what they said the hour before. If the stock market's up, they told you so. If the stock market's down, they told you so.
Right. No, and whatever they said can be reinterpreted to mean the exact opposite.
Right.
Just give them 30 seconds and an opportunity to explore rhetorically what exactly they meant. Kevin, I think the bottom line of what we see developing in the commodities complex, but specifically with gold and silver, is that we have active currency intervention and monetization on a scale that we've never seen in any one country, let alone multiple countries, where it's being done hand over fist. You look at the dollar, you look at the yen, you look at the pound, you look at the euro, and you're going to see the best gold price performance in those countries where the central bankers are just going bonkers to try to maintain normalcy.
Well, and that has, in the past, characterized phase two of a bull market. Phase one is when it's rising in a single currency or maybe intermittently, but phase two of a three-phase bull market, is it not rising in all currencies?
It's rising in all currencies, but it's still doing so in a linear fashion.
Right.
And I think if our listeners want to prepare themselves intellectually and emotionally for what the tail end of a bull market looks like, the tail end lasts 3 to 5 years. You're talking about a transition from linear moves, two steps forward to one step back, to exponential moves, Kevin.
Where the tail goes straight up.
Right. And that's, I think, what we have yet to see in the bull market in metals. I had several calls this weekend from folks who are heavily invested in real estate, and they said, Dave, you know, we're concerned about the utter collapse in the gold market that we've witnessed over the last few days. And I kind of scratched my head and thought, what perspective do they have that has them thinking that this is an utter collapse in the gold market?
Right.
We were at above 1,400. We've slipped below 1,400. We've given up not more than 5% off of a peak. We've seen a 30% gain in 2010 in gold. Is this an utter collapse? And I don't know who they're listening to on CNBC,
right.
But my guess is we have another 7% downside. It doesn't matter if it's 7 or 10. To me, you're still looking at giving up half of the gains that you had in 2010 before you put on that much more by the end of 2011. This is a normal linear, two steps forward, one step back. What follows after the one step back, Kevin?
Yeah, it rising again. In fact, it's very, very welcome to the person who understands the market. They want to see these two steps forward, one step back, because really, when it goes exponential, it goes exponential and then it craters back down. Now, it'll still come down to a higher level than it is now. But, you know, I was thinking about it, David, as you were talking. We've been in the gold business for a long, long time. I've been here for about 23, 24 years, and most of that time throughout the 80s and the 90s, gold just maintained around $300 or $400. A $20 move down or a $15 move down was nothing when gold was $300. But now, when you start to see these moves, they sound like a lot more because it's more dollars. But percentage-wise, it's no different than a $15 drop in gold back in the old days.
It's just not a big deal, Kevin. And it's interesting that we attach more emotion to the dollar figure than we do the percentage figure.
Mm.
But for us in the investment community, that's just not the way you translate it. It's a $100 move up or down at these prices. It is not defining of the trend. The trend is defined by much bigger picture issues, and those things remain firmly intact. As we've been talking about, Kevin, the issues in Europe, they're catastrophic. These are things that we hoped we would never see, but thought that we might, given how unstructured the political side of the EMU was.
Well, you know, this generation has really not gone through an epic paradigm shift, but a collapse of the euro or a collapse of the European Union would be epic, and that would be a paradigm shift very similar to a World War I, a World War II.
We've also had a number of decades, Kevin, where there's been very little social change. I mean, if you go back to the United States specifically, you're talking about the 1960s, maybe epitomized by 1968. What of a dramatic social nature has really changed since the 60s?
Since 1968, really.
And that's, I think, what we're looking at, Kevin. You know, coming back to what we were talking about earlier, Portugal, just as one example of instability, we've got the presidential election coming up on the 23rd. That'll be very telling. We've seen credit default swap spreads in Portuguese debt, on Portuguese debt, rise significantly. And this is a very pressured and tensioned part of the world.
Well, let me ask you, the guy's name is José Sócrates. Are we going to see some similarities or some parallels with José, with the other Sócrates?
Well, it's interesting. You've got the presidential election set next to a prime minister who has a little bit more tenure. But depending on how the presidential election goes on the 23rd of this month, and depending on whether or not the Portuguese need a bailout within the next 30 to 60 days, Sócrates may be forced into his own version of Hemlock, which is just retire. Not retire as in you're dead, because he's not corrupting the youth. Although, we have to ask the question, Kevin. There's two reasons why Sócrates was forced to drink hemlock in ancient Greece. This is about 399.
Right.
One was for corrupting the youth. The other was for refusing to recognize the gods recognized by the state.
Boy, that sounds familiar. Refusing to recognize the gods recognized by the state.
And you wonder if there aren't parallels to those who are accepted in social society and social circles today. Who are the gods of the marketplace today?
Well, David, what are the signs of the rising tensions in Portugal?
And again, if there's a potential loss in an investment, you would expect people to start insuring against that loss.
Okay.
And one of the ways that you can do that is using derivative contracts called credit default swaps. And so what you see is the cost to insure rises where people begin to perceive the risk is also on the rise.
So that's a good indicator or a good meter of rising tension.
Correct. So the CDS spreads, the percentage above your standard treasury yield, they're on the rise in Portugal dramatically here in the last week or two. And again, what does that spell for political decisions that are made? And I'm talking about the man on the street going to voting booth and saying, we approve or disapprove of these austerity measures. We approve or disapprove of the way that you are going to, by force, meet our expectations. It's interesting, Kevin, and this is where I think this year, if you look at 2011 and 2012, it's important to even look beyond the political and realize that the social fabric is being torn to pieces in Europe and in many other places around the world. So, Kevin, just as an exercise, our listeners can tie into the International Herald Tribune or the Financial Times and follow that election on the 23rd, and I'd encourage you just to watch. And in addition to watch, I would encourage you to learn and to remember what this looks like, because the interplay between the political and the social is very important. Politics, though not quite as volatile the world over as perhaps it would be in Spain or Portugal, will look and feel more impassioned anywhere in the world in the years ahead. And it's not as the left-leaning press would cast it. People across the political spectrum have very little emotional capacity to deal with financial pressures. And what comes out of that is blame. That's the common outcome, whether it is from the left or from the right.
David, it's human nature. Even if you bump your head on something, the first person you look at after that, you don't like for a minute or two, because it's like, daggone it, my head hurts, and you're in front of me.
Right.
So in this particular case, if you've got, we talked about it before, unmet expectations or the haves, having somebody's going to be a have, somebody's going to be a have not, and the resentment, when it builds, turns into social tension, and it's caused by extreme differentials.
Well, specifically, Kevin, wealth differentials, where again, like we were talking about last week, Kevin, social tensions in the U.S., on the one hand, you've got bank balance sheets recovering, earnings to a certain degree recovering in areas particularly where the financial system has captured the bailout dollars. And, you know, what you have on the other extreme is the marginally employed or the unemployed who are having a hard time even buying what they need at Walmart. Meanwhile, you've got the other end of the social caste, which is not having a problem buying Louis Vuitton.
Mm-hmm.
So a $3,000 handbag, and everyone else is worrying about how they're going to pay off the credit card bills, which are bigger in January because of what? Because they wanted to buy Johnny and Susie Christmas presents.
You know, David, I'm going to shift gears here again. Harry Schultz, somebody who's been in the industry for many years, a very prominent voice in free press, I would say, as far as independent thinking, has retired. And, you know, he had some comments on retirement that I think are probably worth sharing with the listeners.
Look, Kevin, he's a fascinating man. I've known him since I was probably 10 years old. My dad and I would go and often visit him either in Geneva or in Monaco where he lived. And he, depending on where we were traveling, sometimes he would come up and see us or we'd go down and see him. And so I remember, you know, sitting in many cafes on busy European streets, sitting and having a cup of coffee with him and listening to the conversations between he and my dad.
He really is a permanent tourist, isn't he? And he used to say, and I think this is true, that he was in the Guinness Book of World Records as the highest paid per hour consultant ever. What was it? $2,000-$5,000 an hour back when that was a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. You'd have to go back to the 1960s or 70s when that was put in. And yes, your 45-year legacy, Kevin, of writing the Harry Schultz letter. And, you know, I think of him as someone who is conceptually avant-garde. You know, he was willing to, as a thought leader, not be afraid of putting out his own interpretation of events. And you know, it was almost like he built his own Rosetta Stone and said, you know, this is what's happening in the world. And no one's going to say it quite like I'm going to say it, but there it is. And so, you know, even if it required a change in language, you know, he was the person who coined the phrase stagflation in the 70s. You know, there's a number of things that, again, linguistically, if the concept didn't exist, he was willing to bend language to make it happen. And I just wanted to say something about him in the program today, because there's a number of things that we will retain as a company, having benefited from his legacy in our own tutelage and education.
Well, and to the credit of Harry Schultz, he was very, very careful who he let inherit that letter. And the Aiden sisters, which were guests of ours just a few months ago, are now going to be taking over for that letter.
That's right. Now, it'll be good to see him next time we're in Europe. He's 87 years old, retired, full of vim and vigor. and just wanting to focus on a few other things than writing the letter with all its deadlines and computer glitches. So we look at that, and I want to bring that up for one particular reason, Kevin. Question is often asked, and after we did our three-week series on the Q&As from listeners, a number of people still continue to write in and say, you know, we've thought about spending more time outside the United States. Is there any one place that we should go, any one place that we should spend time? Even if we wanted to be an expatriate living somewhere else in the world, what would that look like? Where would that be? And my answer has always been, and it pointed back to, Harry Schultz. Mm. Being a permanent tourist means that you may have diversified assets outside of the United States, but where you live is very secondary. You can operate and live and enjoy any part of the world, whether it's South America, Central America, Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, Asia. It really matters less where you are than what your mindset is. And Harry Schultz, I think, to me, represents more of a mindset than anything else, and a very healthy one. Someone who was able to thrive and still is thriving, not just surviving the sort of tyranny of the urgent, surviving getting old, surviving any of these things which are externalities, but he's just always thrived.
Yeah, he really has. And David, we talked about this just the other day, how some people have a survival mindset, and that's what they're thinking, survive. How do I survive? How do I get my next meal? How do I get my next breath? How do I support my family? There's nothing wrong with that, but there's a better way. There's a thriving mentality, which says, yes, conditions have changed, but I'm adaptable. My family's adaptable. I'm going to thrive. And if you think about a person who's a, quote, permanent tourist, that person is also probably somebody who can adapt very well to changing economic conditions. This is one of the things that made Harry Schultz so fascinating in reading him, because he was an adapter to a situation. And you think about we're losing a lot of these people, unfortunately, to old age, but there are still people alive who remember the Great Depression of the 1930s. And they didn't just survive. Many of them, with very little money, thrived, and look at that as maybe one of the best decades of their life.
Kevin, and I think thriving is definitely something that has to be redefined, because in our culture it has to do with how much stuff you have and what your balance sheet is and, you know, how many vacations you've taken and where to and how extravagant were they and what are your bragging rights with the friends at the country club, and even if you still have a country club membership.
Right.
These are all things that place emphasis on.
And is my life getting better this year based on those things than last year?
Right. When thriving has very little to do with that, Kevin.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, what you're talking about is a mindset. What you're talking about is a perspective. And I guess that's what I get from Harry Schultz, is not specifically that he lived in Monaco, but that it could have been anywhere. It just happened to be a good place to live. And actually, it's a great place to live. I can only say that from the vantage point of visiting. But there's a flexibility, as you said, of mindset, which is far more important. We're in a period in time where we don't have certitude and certainty about what outcomes will be, whether that's economic, financial, or political. And yet we maintain an attitude and a disposition, which is one of deep curiosity.
Right.
So that our minds are naturally left flexible. When we quit asking questions on this program, we've walked away from flexibility, and we've walked away from our ability to adapt to whatever circumstances may be in front of us. And I think that is where thriving comes, is in the context of adjusting your expectations and recognizing that this is it. This is what you have. Enjoy it. Whatever that is. And, you know, I think, Kevin, that's something that can, even though we may grieve some future state of political tyranny, as we've seen in the past, we will see in the future, and it'll get better. I mean, these things do cycle in and out. But as things change to the degree that we remain flexible and can focus on those things which truly should be priorities, family, friends, community, guess what? That moves us in the direction of thriving and not being held captive by our circumstances. We're not in control of tomorrow, Kevin. We're not in control of what happens socially. We're not in control of what happens politically. We're not in control of what happens economically and financially. And that's the fight that we see at the Fed, is to maintain control of a financial system which has already spun out of control. The wheels are off. and yet we're trying to posture and pretend. And if we can paper over the problem long enough, perhaps we'll enter a period of self-healing, and the economy will be what it once was.
But the better thing to do would be to face the reality.
And adapt.
And adapt.
And adapt. And that's the beauty of a pure capitalism, Kevin, is that the system, market-driven, will adapt. Why? Because that system is driven by the same dynamism that the human soul is driven by as well. We have the ability as individuals to thrive under any circumstances, whether it's slavery or freedom. We can thrive. Kevin, we're not held captive by a world of cause and effect and determinism, which means that there's no way out. This is the end. This is what it looks like. When the municipal bonds fail, when this collapses, when this no longer recovers, when Portugal has riots in the streets, there's a sense in which that has to be stripped away, mm-hmm. and you have to look at the individual. Kevin, this is what von Mises explored in his big, thick book, Human Action, mm-hmm. where he's talking about praxeology, and he ties into the ancient Greek concept of praxis, action, in Aristotle's idea that human flourishing is found in action.
Right.
That action, guess what? Circumstances may change constantly around us, and we still must choose. We still must act, and in that we find our thriving.
Well, and right action actually comes from that curiosity, answering those questions. Well, and that's the wish for our listeners and ourselves, is that we may ever stay curious. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.